Hi, I'm Mark Chavez. I'm one of the hosts of Let's Make a comedy docuseries podcast about the creative process. Each season, my co-hosts, Ryan Beal, Maddie Kelly, and I take on an artistic challenge and you follow our journey. In Let's Make a Sci-Fi, we wrote a science fiction TV pilot. In Let's Make a Rom-Com, we wrote a romantic comedy film. And on our latest season, Let's Make a Horror, we produced a horror short film. And when we run into trouble, we interview Hollywood experts. People who have worked on big things like The Blair Witch Project, The Office, Star Wars, Mamma Mia, and more. All three seasons of Let's Make a are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, it is Friday, January 27th. My name is Tom Power. Welcome to Q.
What's up? This is Robert Glasper.
Hey, I'm Tennille Towns.
Hi, I'm Tomi Adeyemi, and you're listening to Q.
And you're listening to Q.
And you're listening to Q with Tom Power.
So, Paul Mescal is an Irish actor who was just nominated for an Oscar for his role in the new film After Sun, where he plays a father trying to reconnect with his daughter on a trip. But Paul's not a dad in real life, so how do you do it? How do you get in that mindset? He'll tell you how just hanging out on the beach with the young girl who plays his daughter was all the preparation he needed. Paul Mescal, coming up. Plus, Krista Couture is a writer and musician who's learned to make friends with grief. She survived cancer, amputation, death, divorce, and then more cancer. And now Krista is taking what she's learned and sharing a space for others. She'll tell you about her new show, How to Lose Everything. All that and more coming up on Q. Hello, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for tuning in. And thanks to Talia Schlanger for sitting in for me for the past couple of weeks. It is nice to be back. I got some cool news to share about the show later on, but let's get to the meat of the show, shall we? Every year at the Toronto International Film Festival, there are a few films that really get people talking, and After Sun was one of those films this past year. After Sun follows a woman as she reflects on a holiday she took with her father 20 years earlier. She's trying to square her memories of that trip with something new that she's discovered, that her father was struggling with depression in the backdrop of that wonderful trip they took together. So Paul Mescal plays the young version of her father, Callum. He's been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actor. And throughout Paul's career, whether it's After Sun or it's his big breakout role, the place you might know him from in the TV adaptation of Sally Rooney's hit novel Normal People, Paul Mescal has always been really interested in characters that have this complicated internal life but seem relatively normal from the outside. I caught up with Paul Mescal at the Toronto International Film Festival in this little suite we were doing the interviews in. And we talked about why his favorite roles are in stories that show you what the characters are feeling instead of telling you.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Congratulations on the film.
Yeah, thanks very much.
When you read the script, what was it about it?
It was, plainly, it was just such a beautifully constructed script, like as its own thing. I was like, this is pretty much close to perfect. I was, I was really attracted to the idea of playing a young father. I didn't really think about him as a young father. I was just like, there's a lot going on for Callum beneath the surface. And then obviously through chats with Charlie, our director, I was like, she's special and I want to work with her.
Yeah. I mean, and I should be clear for people who don't know. It's sort of her story in
some
ways.
Yeah, it's like as Charlie puts it, it's like a work of, what is it like?
Autofiction.
Autofiction. That's, yeah. Thank you.
I didn't know, but I just assumed it was.
Yeah, she will put it much more elegantly.
You did great.
Yeah, sweet.
I wouldn't know much about acting.
Okay.
So I have some acty questions for you.
Great.
You don't have children yourself.
I do not.
You are, there's a real tenderness from you in this film towards the daughter in the film. How do you get there? How do you get that paternal part of you out there or act as if that?
I just love Frankie.
Do you know what I mean?
It's a departure. Suppose the way that I looked at it was like, I might not be a father, but
you can have that.
I'll take that.
Yeah, you can take that with you.
But I don't know. I don't look at it as binaries. That obviously, I'm like, I need to really invest in the idea of what fatherhood would potentially mean to me. And but then half of the battle is just falling in love with who you're working with. And that was the easiest thing to do with Frankie. But I don't really know how I prepared to be a dad, you know? I just kind of went from his perspective first, not necessarily to do purely with fatherhood, but I was like, what motivates Callum outside of being a dad, and what is he battling with or not battling with? And then the kind of, because I think, sorry, I'm rambling, but
I do understand what you're saying. Yeah.
I feel like Callum treats Sophie like a friend and a sister on top of being her father. So it was, I lent on the kind of complexities of that, I think.
Well, because what it sounds like you're saying to me is that there's a, when you're praising Frankie's, your daughter, who is playing a sort of a facsimile of the director, Charlie, that you are, that the closeness you felt with your co-star allowed, what I read as like and it certainly was there, like a paternal acting, there was a closeness there because of who you guys had a lovely relationship.
Yeah, I think you've said it better than I did.
I can do the rest of your press
if you
want.
Yeah, let's
go. No problem. You can do this if you
hand
want.
Hand me the clipboard. And I'll
no problem. You no problem at all. You know, it's a severe pay cut. How do you build that relationship with her then?
Yeah, so I got over to Turkey we shot the film in Turkey, but we arrived like 2 weeks before filming started.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to Charlie about like, are we going to like rehearse scenes? And we tried that and not that it wasn't working. It just wasn't particularly useful at that moment. So we would just I would spend 2 weeks just kind of hanging out with Frankie and taking her down to get crepes or jumping in the sea, swimming in the pool, playing pool. And just took the pressure or took the focus away from the finished product of like the film and built a trust between us, which I loved.
That's lovely.
Yeah,
it's
really
lovely to
nice.
Have that time.
And her parents were so sound about it. Like they just let me play dad for a little bit and then she'd go back to her real family in the evenings. But it was nice.
It's lovely because to me, I mean, the film is about so much. But one of the things that I thought the film depicted really well, I don't know if you can relate to this. And by the way, I'm not asking you to tell me anything you don't want to tell me.
Yeah, of course.
But there is that moment in all of us when we're growing up that we realize that our fathers or our mothers are not gods.
Yeah.
They're not superheroes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They are people who are struggling with life the same way that all of us are. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I think that's what I find so upsetting about the film when I watch it. You do, like you just hit the nail on the head. It's like, at what point? And I think I have like memories of that. It's like, I remember catching my dad smoking at like 11 and being like heartbroken. And then suddenly you grow up and you're like 18, 19, 20, and you're like, I'm going to have a cigarette and that's fine. And you're like, rules, of course, they're supposed to change. It's like, there's kind of like a purity, I think, with being a kid. And actually that upset that I felt when I saw my dad smoking was rooted in a feeling of love.
Yeah.
So, and there's kind of a like a purity and a kind of simplicity to that, which is beautiful, but also when you get older, you're like, oh, I was probably a little bit harsh on dad at that moment.
I threw my father's cigarettes out.
Yeah, I broke them up.
Me too.
Thinking that he wasn't going to ever be able to buy another box.
I bet he was so mad at you.
He was, yeah.
Yeah, because my father was very mad at me about that too, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's an important moment.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, a friend of mine told me the other day, she was saying that they were watching Jeopardy.
Nice.
You know Jeopardy.
I've been explain Jeopardy to me.
It's like a quiz show in the States, in Canada, but it comes from the States.
Trivia, right?
It's trivia.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But instead of giving you, what is instead of asking like, well, this is you for example, like what is normal people? Oh, it's a show that aired on blah blah blah. They'll say this show aired on blah 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 blah, and the answer is what is normal people? So they say it's a game of answers and questions.
So. Give me an example. Like,
this barnyard animal
pecks
at feed and is used in Kentucky Fried restaurants. And the answer would be...
What is chicken?
That's right.
Okay, what's the what is about?
Well, you're answering, you're giving a question instead of an answer.
Okay, gotcha.
It's a game of answers and questions,
right,
they say.
Right, that makes more sense, yeah. Let's just do Jeopardy for another minutes.
Oh, I got another list here, right? I did pretty good on coming up with a Jeopardy question pretty quickly. Yeah. I'm feeling pretty good about myself. And that was my audition. When you see, my friend of mine, she was watching Jeopardy with her father, and her father got her something wrong.
Right.
And she said, I just thought all of a sudden this idea I had of my father as being the smartest man in the world crumbled. But all he did was just get something wrong, God's sake, you know? Yeah.
I'd be devastated if my dog got something wrong in a trivia game. I'm joking.
He'd be heartbroken. Yeah. But maybe it did, but I was happy I mentioned Normal People just then, because it did make me think about some of the other projects you've done. So, in this film, After Sun, and then your character in Normal People, we were talking about this on the way here, that there's a complicated inner life, and how they express things on the outside isn't always how they feel on the inside.
Yeah.
What is it about that that excites you as an actor or interests you as an actor?
I feel like when I watch stuff that moves me, film, theater, even music, anything, I'm attracted to the idea of like restraint, like creative restraint. Like when you see...
You'd have to explain that one to me a little
bit. So like when you see a character like Callum or Connell, for example, in Normal People, when the filmmakers or the script doesn't explain to you what and why they're feeling a certain way, and it requires a kind of restraint from the filmmakers and also from a performance side of things to kind of show, don't tell. Do you know what I mean? It's about kind of trusting an audience to be smart and with you and kind of front-footed in their response to what they're seeing and to lean in and engage. And I think that's when I see stuff that really moves me, is when I haven't been told how to feel. And I think maybe that's, or I believe that's true of Normal People as a show, and After Sun, I feel like they're in a kind of similar yet incredibly different wheelhouse, you know?
Yeah, it must be hard as an actor. I wouldn't know much about acting.
Totally.
Because in After Sun, your character is, I almost don't want to tell people, but I can say that he is suffering from what seems like a deep depression.
Yeah.
He is, which is the most heartbreaking of all, he's trying to help himself.
Yeah.
He's doing, I think, is that Tai Chi?
Tai Chi stuff is like so devastating, because it's like when you see characters fighting for something, like he's not resolved to a sadness or a disposition, like he's fighting against it. Meditating. There's something kind of like Willy Loman-esque in his like innate being, is like, I don't think Willy Loman's like an excellent father, but one of my favorite things about Callum is that for everything that's going on behind the scenes, I think he's an excellent father. I think there's moments in the film where he messes up, but Charlie's construction of Callum is so wonderfully smart, because I feel like we've seen many kind of neglectful, absent single fathers
in a binary.
They're like one thing, and Callum is a single father. He's going through his own stuff. I feel like he jumps between jobs, but the thing that he is best at is being a dad to Sophie, which is brilliant.
But as an actor, when you deal with that restraint, like when you have this, like, so your character is, and this is just you as an actor, Paul as an actor, you have to be very quiet we have to be able to sort of barely be able to perceive there's something dark on the inside of you, or something that you're struggling with. But there are moments as an actor where you get to yell, very brief moments, you get to yell, spit, really let it out.
Yeah.
What are those moments? How do you approach those as an actor?
I feel like that is the restraint that I'm talking about. It's like holding the audience like a tight, like keeping them on the edge of what they're encountering.
Yeah.
So if you're like restrained in terms of, if you're choosing a script that you feel is like taut and restrained, that's when you really feel like it. I feel like, how many times have you seen actors like scream their way through a film? And if you looked at one of the clips in isolation, you could be like, that's really powerful and moving. But if the film or the TV show or the play has 90% of that performance being that, it doesn't move you. So it's like, to make it specific to Callum, what I loved about that script was that there's kind of a high pressure element to it. It's like Callum has to show his daughter. Whenever he's with his daughter, he's got to be a kind of pillar of strength and has got to give off no kind of perception of being unwell or being upset.
Yeah, can't.
So then you look at the script and you're like, okay, I've got three or four moments where you get to let the audience in, and that's, there's a couple of examples in the film, but there are moments when, as an actor, is exciting and scary because you're like, if I don't land these beats, the audience won't understand.
We get like a minute and a half you get a total footage of you being the character being his true self.
Oh yeah, or his true self,
or like
or a private, him, like it's private public versus private version of the Callum.
You're very thoughtful about acting.
Thank you.
If you don't mind me saying so.
No, thanks.
I don't think that's an odd thing to say.
No, I don't know. It's just a nice compliment.
Have been?
I think so. Yeah. Since I went to drama school, I think it's something that just is something that I spend a lot of time thinking about.
Well, I would talk to actors who would, you know, I show up and do my job and I go home at the end of the day.
I feel like that's probably self-protective though. Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe so. Yeah.
Yeah. Because sometimes I can get, it's embarrassing talking about your work, but other times I'm like, I think it's interesting and cool, and
I think you got a great respect for it.
Yeah,
wasn't your father? Wasn't he?
Yeah, he was an actor. Yeah, or a teacher and actor. Yeah,
that's nice.
Yeah, it's great.
What kind of stuff did he do?
I didn't really have an interest in it growing up, but the first play I saw, I was like 8 or 9 or in that kind of bracket, and it was a one-man show. But I had no perception of what a play is. And he was like wearing like weird costumes.
What was he doing?
It was a play called Jeffrey Bernard is Unwell. And I didn't know that it wasn't going to be just my dad on stage as my dad. You know, like just like it's dad's going to say someone else's words and it's going to look like him. But he was wearing like costumes and like heavy makeup and like fake beards and stuff. And so I was like, it took me like 20 minutes, 30 minutes to be like, when's dad going to come in to the play?
That's lovely, though, isn't it?
It is nice.
That is lovely.
Yeah.
And then that must be the reason you got into it.
Yes and no. I think, like, I feel like I've spent a lot of time talking about my dad, and it's my mum and my dad together are so supportive of, I don't know, in Ireland, I feel like there's less of a trajectory of, like, you can be an actor for your job. It was only, like, at the end of secondary school that I kind of pivoted, and I was like, I think I want to make a go of this, and they were like, whatever you want to do.
Oh, God, I love them. The question I have about that is when you are really as thoughtful as you are, and it means so much to you, as you have told me that you are, remind me your co-star's name again. I'm so sorry.
Frankie Corio.
Who's 12?
Yeah.
And starting out. But I've been really obsessed with the idea of the beginner's mind recently. Like, what, you know.
Right, yeah.
So do you, as a trained actor now.
Yeah.
Learn anything from her as an actor starting out? Not to her specifically, like not as how good she is and all that stuff, but like the fact that she's starting out.
Like her beginner mentality?
Yeah.
There's kind of it's like a factory reset. You know, it's like she's at the beginning, so there's no kind of habits or tricks.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean. Right?
Yeah, I think so. There's like a certain scene in like a mud bath where I'm apologizing to her for, like, without any spoilers, I'm apologizing to her for something.
Yeah.
And it's pretty drastic what has happened. And Frankie and Sophie kind of merged at this moment where Frankie would hate when anything would be sad, which was kind of great because I would try as Callum to not show her that I was sad at any moment.
Oh, yeah.
But there was a moment when he's particularly like, I'm sorry for what happened last night.
Yeah, I know that.
And Frankie would just like refuse to go there, so she just starts like smearing mud on me and totally kind of dissociating, and but also such a beautiful gesture, and I remember my heart was just like it was devastating in the best way, and that's something that I think is a testament to her as an actor, but also to her as a beginner. You know, it's like pure instinct to just go, I'm not comfortable with this conversation, so I'm going to divert my attention somewhere else.
I only got a minute left with you, but I'm going to ask you a question anyway.
Go for it.
So then they can beat the door down.
Yeah.
Don't
please.
We paid for the door. I find someone like you very interesting. I've talked to a couple of people like you like this, who, while we were all trapped inside our homes, mm-hmm. something very momentous happened to that, either be like an album blew up during the pandemic and all of a sudden you go from heaven, you know, you're able to live your life too, while you're inside watching your life change.
Yeah.
And I had to imagine that that must have happened to you with Normal People, mm-hmm. because that show, I mean, based on the novel, of course, but that show really takes off in a major way, at least over here, while we can't go outside, while you can't go to receptions and while you can't blah, 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 blah. While rewarding, I bet it's also unmooring. What is that like?
I like it's really nice having kind of a little bit of an opportunity to zoom out from that time, because in the middle of it, I remember being like, "What is happening?" Like,
really?
It's like in both like positive and negative. I was like, "This is incredible. I'm going to get to go forward now and make work because of this show." And it wasn't a show that was kind of just popular and not critically well received. It was like both those things. It was like popular and a really, I think, well-constructed show with Lenny and Daisy. I think for all of us, we had very kind of specific responses to like the like world-expanding view that it gave me of what this job can do, but also how kind of restricting it can be. And I feel like now...
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I understand.
Like, it was restricting in the sense that there's a pressure. Like, people now know what you look like and where you live.
And and your Instagram.
What your personal life is and what you're, who you're hanging out with and who you're not hanging out with. And that's all the bad side of it. And I can park that there and be like, that's okay. You learn to live with that shift. But ultimately, it's been just phenomenal. It's like I'm here talking to you about a film that I made last year because of that show. I've made literally my best friends on that show. And that's kind of my, and I'm sure my perception on that time will evolve as I get further away from it. Maybe I'll miss it more than I thought I would or not. I don't know yet.
Well, with this, and I'll close off this way, with this, I love what you said, that it gave you the opportunity to make the work that you want to make, you know. So given that you have, at this stage, not every actor gets this stage very much, mm-hmm. but sort of a stage where you have a little bit more choice, mm-hmm. you have a little bit more option. What kind of stories do you want to tell going forward?
I don't know if I have like a roadmap or kind of a checklist. I think it's always going to be related to the filmmaker or director and the source material. Like if it's a character that I feel like I can represent accurately and truthfully, I'm going to do that. I'm excited to go back on the stage. I'm going back and doing Streetcar Named Desire in London this...
Oh, go away.
Yeah, this winter.
The big role?
The big Stella, yeah. Oh. Screaming and roaring, yeah.
Have you done it yet? Have you yelled Stella yet?
I've yelled it in the mirror and disturbed my neighbors. No, I haven't. I'm like, we'll get to that in rehearsal, I'm sure.
But you going back to that gives you...
I just miss the kind of the private like 5-week rehearsal period where nobody sees anything. You're just making, you're making a play for yourselves. Like this kind of like band of thieves. Is that the phrase?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then you put it out in the world and you're experiencing it live with an audience. It kind of shortens that distance, I think, between artist and audience.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's lovely to talk to you. Thanks for indulging me in my acting questions.
Thank you very much.
And if you end up hosting Jeopardy, I'd like a cut.
Exactly, yeah.
I'd like
20%.
A finer fee or something. I'll take it. Paul Mescal, lovely to meet you.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Paul Mescal stars in the new film After Sun. He's been nominated for Best Actor at this year's Academy Awards. There is a video of me and Paul Mescal, and it's the video of me explaining Jeopardy to him. It sort of went viral on TikTok in a weird way. So I think what I can do is you can see it on my TikTok. Thomas J. Power is my TikTok. But yeah, me and Paul Mescal hanging out. The Oscars are handed out March 12th in Los Angeles. Because I tear out the pages that I've got in these books. Some words to get some reward, and I'd show you all the photographs That's Deacon Blue from 89 with a song called Real Gone Kid. The song is featured in the new movie After Sun, starring Paul Mescal. If you missed our conversation, you can find it on the CBC Listen app.
One of the best shows of the year, according to Apple, Amazon, and Time, is back for another round. This season, we're diving deep into some of McCartney's most beloved songs. Yesterday, Band on the Run, Hey Jude. And McCartney's favourite song in his entire catalogue. Here, there, and everywhere. Listen to Season 2 of McCartney, A Life in Lyrics, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Tom Power. So, a few years back, the singer-songwriter Krista Couture came up with what she called a grief bio. And it goes like this. Cancer, amputation, death, death, divorce, and more cancer. That's a lot for anyone to carry around with them. So in 2020, Krista publishes this memoir, and it's called How to Lose Everything. And it's this book where she sort of pieces together all these experiences. I mean, how she lost her leg to cancer when she was a kid, or the deaths of her two sons, Emmett and Ford, as babies, the collapse of her marriage, and the thyroid cancer that threatened her career as a singer. So now Krista is sharing that loss with other people and sharing that space of loss and how you cope with other Indigenous folks like her. Krista is the new creator of this new animated series that's out today on CBC Gem. Same title as her memoir. It's called How to Lose Everything. A different Canadian artist animates every story. So Krista came into the studio to talk about the new show, to talk about what we can learn from grief, but also to talk about what we can learn from one another when we go through hard times. Hi.
Hi.
It's funny when you came in, when you were like, I was like, you know, we were joking around about the interview and you said, we have folk dirt on one another.
Yeah, we both come from the folk world.
We both have played a lot of folk festivals,
yes.
The same ones,
yes.
To a lot of people wearing Birkenstocks.
We have. It's a good life, to be clear.
Do not get me wrong. Would not trade
we're
it
not
in for
knocking
the world.
It.
Let's talk a little bit about let's talk first about the book. So How to Lose Everything is such a personal story. It's about those losses that I mentioned, how you weathered those losses. Take me back to the memoir and maybe what made you want to share that in the first place?
For a couple reasons. I'd been telling these stories of my experiences through my music for so many years, which, as you know, is like verse, chorus, verse, and you're out. And I kind of was always kind of scratching this itch. I wanted to say more. I wanted to say more. I needed to say more. And so the book was partly for myself to tell these stories in a more thorough way. And in the way that I wanted to tell them. I think sometimes, too, when people would hear, you know, the grief bio or even just, you know that I lost my leg or only know that I lost my children and, you know, wow, that's so terrible or what's it like being an amputee? And I kind of wanted to answer people's questions. People are curious about me sometimes. And so I decided to put that in the book. But I also wanted to create something, kind of an offering for other people going through their own experiences of loss. There were so many books and songs that saved me in the way that art can, right? When you find something that you see yourself in. And I wanted to give back in a way. And so I shared my story to add to what's out there for people to find, you know, either through their own grief or if they're supporting someone in grief.
Did it work? Like, did you get what you needed from doing that?
Yeah. Which led to making the series in a way. I felt like in making the book, I was at a place in my life where all of those stories were firmly in the past. Like, I couldn't have written that book while that stuff was still happening.
While you were processing.
Yeah, I mean, when you're going through grief, like particularly with like the losses of my sons, I mean, I was in pieces for years. And writing a book is a literal putting pieces together. There's a beginning, a middle, and end. And I couldn't have done that task if I was still, you know, in the swirl of the immediate years of grief. And so creating the book just, it finally kind of got it out of me in a way. And I told my story. It's mine. I said it in the way that I wanted to. And that led in a way to the series, because it was like, oh, let's talk about other people's stories. Like, yeah, I want to help other people share their experiences.
My guess would be that when you share experiences like this, that have happened to you, other people would want to share them with you. Like other people would want to come up and talk to you. Would I be right?
Yeah. I've had a lot of, I love this.
You do.
But, you know, at shows when I was playing like live music, and people would come up to me after and tell me about the person that they lost and tell me that person's name. I started trying to do it before shows so that I could dedicate something to that person that night. And people write me letters. People send me things, which is the final passage in my book has this line that says, you know, you can tell me, tell this book, tell this page your story, and I'll remember for you. And I got a letter at some point when the book came out, my publicist forwarded. She's like, somebody took this literally. I was like, they're supposed to.
Yeah, yeah.
I want people to tell me. I want people to reach out.
And is that what leads to – because what we're talking about today is not just a new program that is sort of an animated, quasi-animated story of your story, but it is also a number of programs about – other people sharing their own experiences of loss. Is that how that happened? Like you wanted to share some of that, some of those stories, or you wanted to share some of that space, or?
It started as, the film series started as just one film. It started as just my story, this final passage from the book that's called The Field Guide. But through the funding that we got, the idea was sparked, was like, well, maybe it can grow into something bigger. And I was like, well, sure, what would something bigger be? And I was like, well, maybe it's a series of films, and maybe those films are by other artists. And that just like something lit in me when I heard that. I was like, yes, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do. Because I've been collecting people's stories, because people have been waiting at shows and sending me letters, it's like, oh, we could put them somewhere. And so that first film became a kind of invitation, because that first film is saying, tell me your story. I went to these other writers and was like, what's your response? What would you say in response? And so four other writers who are all Indigenous created these other pieces of what it brought up for them, the sad story they wanted to tell, or the story of loss that they wanted to tell.
Tell me about the decision to choose other Indigenous writers.
I mean, I'm mixed Cree and Scandinavian. I'm disabled. I'm queer. I'm a mom. I generally try to like only work with people who line up with at least one of those, or folk music. Or if you're a folk musician, you can come in. It just matters to me whether that's other artists or like a plumber. I think about who I'm working with and who I'm, you know, financially supporting. But it just became, I'm really interested in the storytelling from Indigenous communities. I'm really interested in Indigenous animation. I didn't know until this project that there were so many Indigenous animators, and of course there are. And it kind of, it just was sort of a connecting of dots that this project became more specifically Indigenous storytelling. It didn't start that way, but it just was like led in that direction. I'm really glad it was.
I want to listen to it a little bit of it. So this is from your episode, the first episode of the series, How to Lose Everything. This is The Field Guide, as you mentioned. You're reading, I think, an excerpt from your memoir. Mm-hmm. Take a listen to this.
Being awake is the first and hardest thing to get through, and you may ache every minute of the hours in between the relief of sleep. The ache will overwhelm you at times. The ache will press on your chest so hard it might be difficult to move. The ache will shake through your body in uncontrollable sobs. The ache will numb you to all feeling. The ache will want to break things. The ache won't care what does break.
That's my guest, Krista Couture, in Field Guide, which is the first episode of a 5-part animated series called How to Lose Everything, which is out today on CBC Jim. The relief of sleep got me, Krista.
Do you know that feeling?
Yeah.
Right? You just can't wait to fall back asleep. And then when you wake up, you're kind of sad.
Yeah. Because you're waiting for that.
Yeah.
Like a liminal space where you don't really exist.
Yeah. Where you just get to check out a bit. I mean, there's other ways to check out too, but sleep is a nice one.
Yeah. That line got me. For people who are listening to this, can you give an idea of like what, I mean, I'm going to do something very challenging right now, but you're a radio host. You can do this. What does that look like? When people boot this thing up, like an old computer apparently, what will they see? Like, how did your collaborator in you know, Becky O'Neill and you like, decide to how you wanted to animate this feeling?
It just came through conversations about what is the feeling of that heaviness. And we decided to use this image throughout that most of the film of a wolf, this constant companion that's it kind of gets domesticated throughout, which is what for me grief, I often personify grief. Grief is also personified in this film as this sorrow, this woman who's all blue. And I feel like I've developed a relationship with grief that feels like having a pet or a roommate, you know? And for a while, they're a really crappy roommate. And now we live together pretty well. Or the wolf now, you know, knows how to behave and doesn't try to kill me in the night. And so in the film, visually, it's this creature that it's a wild animal. You know, it might turn on you, but at the same time, it stays close by all the time. And so that's what we were going for in those visuals.
It also is worth mentioning that can we talk about the language here?
Yeah.
Because the series is offered in English. I watched it in English. It's going to be available in French as well.
Yes.
And in a Cree version as well. Is that right?
Well, the series is available in the indigenous – each episode is available in the indigenous language of the writer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So my episode and the second episode, A Bear Named Jesus by Archer Pachawis, are both in Cree, Y dialect. The third episode, Heart Like a Powwow, is in Anishinaabe Moen by Tara Williamson. The fourth is in Tanaka by Smoky Sumac. And the fifth is in Inuktitut by Takralik Partridge.
How was the experience of reading your story in Cree?
I don't speak Cree. So for me to record the Cree narration, I had a language coach in my headphones, Charlotte Ross, kind of feeding me sometimes one word at a time. And for the Cree speakers who listened to my episode, thank you for your grace with my performance. I'm learning. It was really from scratch.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. But so I had Charlotte in my ear and we'd rehearsed a few times and we'd met a few times. And something she shared with me was the idea of a language spirit that's within each of us and not just indigenous people. I mean, for whatever your, you know, the language maybe of your grandparents or your ancestral language that's in your blood somewhere. And that anytime we spend with that language, either speaking it or listening to it, we feed that spirit, we nurture it, and it strengthens. And I had that experience even in just saying, repeating these words that Charlotte was teaching me to say. I felt like something was waking up inside of me. It was beautiful. And when I was practicing it, it felt in my body and in my mouth, and the way it came out, I felt like something was waking up. And I feel very moved by that. And it hasn't been in my own world a priority yet to learn the language, but I feel very sort of sensitive to that.
Yeah.
So I feeling, you know, strongly about the importance of language revitalization and feeling then that and if I have an emotional response in doing the Cree, it's because of that awareness. And what happened with this series and something around the language pieces is so with Cree, you know, there's five major dialects. Anishinaabe Moen, there's a very, you know, number of dialects. Inuktitut, so many dialects because they're all, you know, all over the place. But Tanaka, which is spoken, which is from a very small community in BC, and there isn't one single fluent speaker. And it's language isolate, so there's not any language that's like it. It's this singular, endangered, truly endangered language. And it took months for that translation to take place. It took a lot of contacting different elders, and then, you know, you book the meeting, and then someone died in the community, and then we couldn't have the meeting, and we wait another month. And it was an incredible amount of work to get the Tanaka translation done. And so that film in particular is a really powerful piece of not just revitalization or expression, but preservation. There's nothing like it in that language. And so that really excites me. And so I think the feeling, that idea of like a language spirit, you know, or in other terms I talk a lot about with this, that the TRC, like call to action number 14 is around language preservation. I mean, that's another angle at this. But that sort of like bubbling I feel is connected to, I think, the importance and power of these languages being strengthened and preserved.
I want to go back to something you said about like feelings being sort of awoken in you. And maybe this is a good way to close things off. Like when you share a story with others, it is one feeling. What is the feeling you got having your story sort of shared back to you, like watching it as opposed to giving it?
The experience for me was freeing. You know, I have been through so much, and it took me a long time to be able to talk about it and to make art about it and share in a way that feels good for me to do. And it does. It feels good for me to tell these stories. And also, I want, through all this work that I've done, to be freed of some of that heaviness that I have lived with. And so seeing that film and seeing the other artists, you know, we heard a bit of Chris Dirksen's cello and Becky's visuals, and that other people came in and are kind of taking some of the weight and sharing it with me. I don't know how else, if that, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Felt very freeing. And by putting this out in the world, it's like, oh, I don't have to carry it by myself. This is now this other thing, and it can live its life, and I can keep going on and living my life, and we don't have to be so attached at the hip, because now it's going to serve its own purpose.
Other people are walking the dog. Other people are walking
the
wolf.
That's right. Other people can take the wolf for a walk, and thank goodness, you know, we all need that.
It's so beautiful.
Thank you.
It's so beautiful. It's so well done. I hope if you're listening to this, you can watch it. It's out now on Jam, so you should be able to watch it right now. Krista, lovely to see you again.
You too.
I love that idea of the grief and the hardship being the wolf, and other people are able to take that wolf for a walk so that she doesn't have to do it anymore. Krista Couture is the creator of the new animated series, How to Lose Everything. I can't recommend it enough. The episodes are short and so powerful. It's out today on CBC Gem. You can get the app or go to the website. Here's Krista Couture now with her song, Rebuild.
No, we'll make it back. We'll rebuild like always. And though under attack, we'll rebuild always. Careful, you're in shock. Like I'm one to talk, a lustrum of this loss.
A little bit of Krista Couture and Rebuild. Her new animated series, How to Lose Everything, is out today on CBC Gem. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Even if you don't know the name Kenya Barris, you've likely heard his work. For 8 seasons, his autobiographical sitcom Black-ish aired as part of ABC's primetime comedy lineup. It was a show that brought issues of race and class to a mainstream audience through the day-to-day lives of a black family that looked a lot like Kenya's own. Next came Grown-ish and Mixed-ish. But Kenya has contributed in other ways, too. Beyond the screen, Kenya helped get Juneteenth recognized as a federal holiday in the U.S. He's also amplified black stories with Enter Galactic, an adult animated music television special created by the musician and actor Kid Cudi, which is a visual companion piece to the album of the same name that came out last year. Now Kenya's directed his first feature film. It's called You People, about an interracial couple facing the ultimate test of meeting the parents. It seems like Kenya always has projects on the go, so I spoke with him around the time Enter Galactic came out. We talked about a lot of stuff, working with Kid Cudi, and how his work has paved the way for other black writers.
I asked Cudi to do me a favor, and he's such a sweet guy. He did something for my daughter. Actually, he came and spoke at my daughter's school, and the kids went crazy for him, and he was so just sincere and just honest. And like, I was like, hold on, what's going on? And I realized that he was bigger than I remembered. You know what I'm saying? And like, he almost gave birth to this like subgenre of music. Like, you know, we can say emo rap or whatever the case, but kids talking about, you know, depression and how they feel and things like that. And it was like, you know, he's like a maverick and a trendsetter. And so Cudi had talked about doing something that wasn't traditional. And we kind of talked about his life and, you know, and his love life. And we felt like this would be something that we could, should, you know, kind of explore. And Cudi played a song.
Get ready, pop it, let's go. Intergalactic, you and me. Intergalactic, you and me. Get ready, pop it, let's go. Intergalactic, you and me.
And I was like, dude, we have to call Netflix. And Cudi's always been someone who, like, his aesthetic, and he's always been ahead of the curve. And yeah, I've always wanted to sort of, like, the things that I do, I want to feel like it's done, but it doesn't feel like it's been done before in the way that it's done.
So let's hear a bit of the show here. This is a scene from Intergalactic, which is an animated project created by you and Kid Cudi. It's this romantic boy meets girl story, showcases songs on Cudi's new album, which drops at the same time.
You gonna ride that to valet?
Ha ha, funny. Nah, get on.
You know, I came here in a Maybach.
Yeah, and you're leaving on a Mongoose. Unless you don't want to ruin that little cocktail dress of yours. What is that anyway? Prada?
It's Valentino. And don't try and play me.
Never have I seen someone so pretty. Wow.
Yeah, I think this is something that comes up a lot for you. I was thinking about a sports film with Snoop Dogg coming up.
Fat Joe.
Fat Joe and the Vince Staples show, right? So, like, is there something about you that people don't just want to work with you, but they want to work with you on things they've never done before?
I think I've been really, I will say, blessed and sort of like lucky to sort of be from that hip hop generation.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Where I sort of get it. You know what I'm saying? A path that a lot of these guys have been on. We've had some success and we sort of share that. Fortunately, unfortunately, there's a little bit of a singularity in terms of I had some success and I understand that story. And I understand these guys because I've been a fan of their music. And so I think one of the things that for me that I've been lucky is that I don't want to do things that don't feel elevated. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to do it in, you know, quote unquote, would say black, the black show or the black. That's fine with that. But I want to do it in a way that feels like it is definitely from a black eye and from our people, but at the same time speaks to everyone. I think that's like the key to sort of like how we're most impactful.
But also I know that comes with a price. You have black critics saying that, you know, your stuff is too broad. It's too much for a white audience. You have white, from what I understand, you have like white network executives saying, we don't understand this. This is not for us.
Mm-hmm.
With that goal comes criticism and a challenge.
You know, Black AF was a series I did on Netflix.
Yes.
You know, probably was the most split down the middle in terms of people. Some people really, really, really seemed to like it. Some people just didn't get it. But it, for me, was the example of what I wanted to do as an artist moving forward. Because, you know, it caused conversation. You know what I'm saying? When you walk out of a museum, you're like, let's go get something to eat. And that museum was a failure. You know what I'm saying? Like every piece of art, when you look at it, it should make you feel something. You want to like it or hate it or talk about it. You know what I'm saying? And I kind of think that was really what I wanted to do sort of just moving forward. Like I really learned that.
I want to talk about the episode of Black-ish you shot in 2017 called Please Baby Please, which takes place over one night at their household. No one can sleep. A lot of discussions come up about the anxieties around being black at that time in America. The episode gets shelved at that time, doesn't air until during the pandemic.
Hey, if Daddy tells you a secret, do you promise to keep it to yourself and not tell anybody? Daddy's scared too, but not about the thunder. Maybe a little bit about the thunder. But it's more about the world. Everything's so crazy right now. Hey, I'm sorry to dump all this on you, little man.
I left Disney.
Yeah.
After that.
Yeah.
And I left people who were really good friends. And for me in particular, it felt like I wasn't being true to my audience if I didn't stick behind that. And at the same time, that company was going through a really major merger. And there were things in that episode that could have potentially derailed the merger.
The school wants to suspend any athlete who take a knee during the national anthem.
That is ridiculous. And you're filled with fury and rage. That's why you can't fall asleep, right?
Well, actually, I don't even know why I get my hopes up.
I knew my time in telling stories there for that particular time had probably come to an end, you know what I'm saying, where I had done as much as I could do. And I got a really unique opportunity in going to Netflix, you know, and taking chances and taking risk, you know what I'm saying, but believing in, like, when I left Netflix and went to, you know, Viacom, which is now Paramount International, I got a percentage of the studio that we know, or equity in the studio, which at the time was like kind of unheard of. But at the same time, it gave, as a writer and other writers, hopefully moving forward, a chance to sort of have transparency and look at like how the process works, where our money goes, betting on ourselves, you know what I'm saying, and things like that. So I've been really lucky sort of to be in a position where I can take some of those risks and hope that they pay off.
When you're trying to make anything, you can get lost in the details of it. You can get lost in the criticism of it. You can get lost in the otherness of it. And then every now and then you get a little moment where you start to realize that the work you're doing is bigger than the work itself. Great, great joy to meet you. Thanks for making the time.
You too, man. And your research, who's the department doing your research? You going to loan them out? You had a quick second to get some pretty good sound bites.
That was enjoyable. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man. Nice meeting you.
My conversation with Kenya Barris, who is the director and writer and producer. His first feature film, You People, debuts today on Netflix. My name is Tom Power. So I'm so happy to say my friend Elamine Abdel-Mahmoud is back with me this morning to talk about the brand new show that will be landing in this spot on Monday. It's called Commotion. He and his team have been working really hard for the past couple of months to bring it to you. Elamine, how are you? Yeah. I feel like I talked to you like...
I was just sitting in your office earlier.
I talked to you like 6 hours a day. I've gotten so little done.
Yeah, I know.
Each of us have.
I'm so sorry.
Each of us have gotten very
little
done.
Since I moved into this building, it's been a real problem. I don't feel good about it. I'm sorry.
I feel great about it. I'm having a great time.
I have to tell you, I am so honored to be sharing the stage with a world-famous Taurus. I hear that it's a huge thing that you're the most world-famous Taurus has ever been. It's you and Adele.
It's me and Adele and the Ford Taurus. Elamine is referring to a TikTok that is of me and Omar Apollo, who was also singing that joke.
That went viral.
Yeah. Can I tell you a story about that?
Please tell me
a story. So if you're listening to this and you don't know, in the video, Omar Apollo asks me what sign I am in the middle of the interview, and I say I'm a Taurus. And he says, oh, yeah, right on. And he says something like, I get that, right? Or something like that.
First of all, he lit up. His whole face lit up. He was like, get out. You're a Taurus? I'm a Taurus, too. And then the energy of the interview shifts.
Because I say, I don't know what that means.
Yes.
I don't know anything about astrology.
And then Omar is, for the rest of the interview, in love with you. That's how I would put it. Is that how you put it?
We were very friendly afterwards. Yeah. And I have, the other day I was standing at the corner of Queen and Spadina in Toronto. I was walking home and a young woman looked at me and she said, Taurus.
Just pointed at you and said, Taurus.
Hey, Taurus. And that's I was like, great. Hey, how's it going? Yeah. Turns out she was talking to the car.
Great.
It was the Ford
Sorry
Taurus.
To derail this.
It was a Ford Taurus driving by. all right, let's get some questions out of the way about this new show, because I'm sure everyone's wondering.
Yeah.
Why this show and why now?
Well, I've been a part of this building for a little while, having some pop culture conversations on a show called Pop Chat. That show is once a week. We are now going to do this every single day. There's something really exciting to me about the fact that we get to have arts, entertainment, pop culture conversations every day, because these are the spaces where I live generally. These are the conversations I want to have all the time. That's the background that I come from. I'm a culture writer by trade, you know? So like this, for me, just opens up a whole new avenue because I think they're urgent. You know, I don't know about you, I've never walked into a party and it was like, hey, do you guys want to talk about inflation today? Like that's never been the thing that people say to me when they're walking to a party. But they do want to talk about the shows that they're watching or the songs that they're listening to or like the big sort of internet-y debate that they just got into. Things that end up really lighting up your life. Like they end up meaning a lot because they become the connective tissue between people.
One, people have said that to me, but only when...
Well, you go to fancy parties.
When the party involves blowing up balloons.
Good Lord.
Sometimes I'll go to a balloon-blowing party and they'll be like, do you want to talk about inflation? I go, yeah. I mean, how big do you want these balloons to be?
We go to different parties, man.
Two, I understand what everyone else can get from this, the offer. What do you like about it, though?
I'm one of those people who think that the pop culture we consume becomes a part of us. And sometimes in ways that we don't even necessarily think about. Like we don't necessarily think about, hey, what am I taking away from this show? What am I taking away from this big cultural debate that everybody's having right now? And it just kind of settles into you. And I think why I got into culture writing is to, in a way, explain why is that thing registering with people and not the million other things it could be. And sometimes it's really fascinating, like the sort of doors that ends up opening. Sometimes it's like, this just went viral because it's funny. It's not, you know, it's not that deep. Those will not be the conversations we have. I think we'll get really insightful, smart people who can comment about you know, an artist's place on the world stage in terms of like the cultural conversation we have. Why do we talk about Beyoncé the way we talk about Beyoncé? Like, these questions to me are big curiosities that I think I kind of inherited because I came to this country when I was 12. And my first question was like, why are people the way that they are? Why is Nelly Furtado singing about being like a bird? Like, I don't get what that means. And pop culture kind of becomes a way for me of decoding the world. And I don't think people are that different, because the ways that we consume pop culture open up to the larger questions that we're all sort of obsessed with.
You've been on a journey to get to the CBC for a while. You've been in and out of the CBC. I used to see you around the building a little bit.
It's true.
I knew you from At Issue on the National.
Yeah.
I knew you from Pop Chat, of course.
Yeah.
Party Lines, the podcast, the political podcast.
Politics podcast.
But can you tell everybody about your first gig at the CBC?
I'd love to. It was 11 years ago. It was March of 2012. And I got to this building on a 30-day contract to work on a show called George Strombolopoulos Tonight. That was at that iteration, Strombo had moved from The Hour to George Strombolopoulos Tonight, which is like this like nightly talk show. And my job was a PA. I was a production assistant. And my very specific job literally was to go every day to Queen Video, which is like this like former – it doesn't even exist anymore. It's an old video store that used to exist on Queen Street in Toronto.
If you're listening to this and you're not – you're younger than a millennial, so you used to have to go to – you used to have to go to stores and rent or buy films.
So I had to go rent DVDs in order for the video editor on George Stompolopoulos Tonight to put together like the video package. So say like, I don't know, Jeff Goldblum was coming on the show. I'd have to go to Queen Video and say, hey, do you have copies of like Jurassic Park? Because our video editor needs to splice it together. It needs to be DVD quality because the internet doesn't have good enough, you know, video clips. That was my job. And then at the end of the day, I'd usher in the audience for the taping. And then I'd watch them and watch their faces delight.
And did you think, oh, you know, I think I'd like to do something like that one of these days?
I did. But, you know, I got into this building on a 30-day contract, and that became a 6-month contract. But because it's a show that has summers – some shows, you know, like they just don't operate during the summers. And then the summer came and I thought, man, my landlord does not care that it's summer. They still expect rent. The only thing that didn't have seasons was the news, which is actually why I switched to the news. So my second job in this building
– I love this
– was the National.
Yeah.
And there
– tell them.
I rolled prompter, man. I rolled prompter and I printed scripts.
What does roll prompter mean?
So the anchor is looking at the camera.
Peter Mansbridge.
At the time, Peter Mansbridge was looking at the camera. And then there, the teleprompter would be telling him, you know, like the script for the show for that day. It was my job to roll prompter to keep up with the speed that Peter Mansbridge was reading the news at. And listen, that varies. The hardest day that I ever had to do that was he did a show from Halifax, live in Halifax, and the teleprompter was being beamed into an iPad that somebody else was holding in front of him.
You were not in Halifax.
I was right here in Toronto, and they told me, hey, like 5 minutes before the show started, they're like, hey, by the way, there's like a 3-second delay between when you roll prompter here and when it gets to Halifax. So I had to like figure out how to roll prompter 3 seconds ahead so that by the time it reaches Peter, it's on time. Best day of my life. That was like, by the time I got done, I was like, this must be what, like, I don't know, being on the battlefield feels like. It was just like such high adrenaline, but it went great.
I love that that's how you got started at the CBC.
Yeah.
And I love that that's how that's where we are right now. Now, over the past couple of weeks, now people listening to this would know this, but Elamine's actually been doing the show. So oftentimes when you launch a new show in the CBC, one of the things that happens is you do these sort of ghost shows, practice shows, you know, oftentimes 2 weeks, and you'll have guests and you'll have panelists and you'll essentially do the show live every single day. To nobody, your team.
Yeah.
What have you learned about yourself doing these practice shows?
Well, I learned that I have time blindness. It's a what?
Like face blindness, smell blindness.
Time blindness is a thing.
It also sounds like a Dream Theater album.
It does. It's a real thing, though. It's a sort of like a lack of awareness of like how much time has been. Like, yeah. I get up in the morning and I'm trying to get ready. It's like 8:10 in the morning. I think that by the time that I'm done getting ready, it's still 8:10. Like time sort of stops for a period of time.
Yeah.
But in the chair, when you're doing a show that is live, you have many people who are like, time is currently passing as we speak. And so I've had to, you know, get myself out of the mode of not thinking that time passes when I'm doing stuff.
Can I tell you something that happens when you do that long enough?
Tell me.
You have an uncanny ability to know how long you have been somewhere.
That's what I would like. I desperately want that.
Let's say if you have like a massage appointment or something like that,
yeah.
And you have an hour-long massage appointment.
Just in your body.
You kind of go like, it's been about 47 minutes. Really?
That sounds like a superpower.
Yeah.
Especially to me, who's someone who's like has this time blindness. Yeah. It's literally not fathomable to me to have that.
Can I tell you this though?
Yeah.
I'm still late for everything all the time. So
good. That's a relief.
It doesn't cross over.
Good.
What have you planned for the show or the debut week?
Oh, buddy. Okay. So the first day we're having this conversation about Pamela Anderson has a new documentary out.
Canadian actor.
Yeah.
Pamela Anderson.
One of the most famous faces of the 90s. Mm-hmm. You know, she has a new documentary out.
Home Improvement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Valerie Irons Protection.
Barbed Wire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's perfect. Mm-hmm. But the new documentary is done with her participation. What's interesting to me about this is that there's like this recent run of documentaries where celebrities have a documentary made about them. But they're also like one of the producers, also like they're an active participant. I don't know about you. Like I'm not very good at telling my own story. And I watch these documentaries like Shawn Mendes had one where he's the executive producer, Selena Gomez, Demi Lovato. There's been a bunch of these. And I am curious if you can take them at their word for it or not. You know, if you can sort of buy into their own version of their own mythology. Janet Jackson had a recent documentary that she was also involved in the making. And I would say like I left that documentary thinking, I don't think I learned anything new. I think I just kind of learned – like this felt like a PR exercise. But I think what's interesting to me about Pamela Anderson is that this is someone who went through hell. Like the way that people have talked about Pamela Anderson was so degrading, so misogynistic for so long. There was that show, Pam and Tommy, that came out last year. So you would think, of course, someone like Pamela. Why would she ever be interested in just giving someone else control? Of course, she'd want to be involved in this. And so we're going to be talking to a couple of people about that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely onto something. I cannot wait to hear all about that.
Yeah.
I could talk to you about it for another 20, 30 minutes.
Let's do it.
But judging by my time, no, I've been doing it. I think it's been about 17 minutes and 27 seconds. I am excited about the show. I am so excited that those of us in Canadian media and just those of us who have spent time with your work over the years have always known that more people needed to hear it.
Thanks,
and it was a matter of time. So I am so happy that these little pockets of fans you had with whether through Pop Chat or through Priority Lines or through @issue and definitely through your BuzzFeed newsletter, which you did for a long time, which was mm-hmm. how I was introduced to you.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that people across this country are going to get to spend some time with you every day.
Tom Joe Power. That's very kind. Thanks, man.
Well, I mean it. El Amin Abdok Mahmoud is the new host of Commotion. Didn't even have a joke for you at the end. Just pure sincerity.
So nice.
Airing right here in this time slot on your CBC radio dial, 11 o'clock everywhere except Newfoundland and Labrador, where you can catch it at
11:30.
That's
right.
But it's here's it. Can I give you something?
Is it a Newfoundland tidbit?
Newfoundland and parts of Labrador.
Oh, that's
some
right.
of Labrador is on the Newfoundland time zone.
Yeah.
Some of Labrador is on the Atlantic time
Thanks
zone.
Thanks for clarifying.
Newfoundland
this.
And parts of Labrador.
Very tourist behavior.
Who? Me?
Yes, you.
And I don't know much about astrology. I have to tell you what that means. Of course, you can stream it when you like at CBC Listen, and you can find it as a podcast. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Not the only change going on around here is a Commotion that's going to be coming up on CBC. We're also bidding farewell today to a good friend of the show, the Q theme, like this one. I have like a Pavlovian response to want to talk over that as it starts playing to tell you what time it is. That song, I want to let you know, is actually a song called Tell Me by a band called Bros. And Bros is Seamus Curry and his brother Ewan Curry, who you might know best from Saskatchewan's favorite, the Sheepdogs. I'm happy to say Seamus is live with me in the studio. We're going to talk about his new project. But before we get to that, Seamus, how nice to see you.
Great to see you, Tom.
Thanks
How
for,
are you?
Thanks for being here. I'm really good. Thank you so much for composing. I remember in the early days of the show when we landed on your song for that theme, I felt like I was really nervous about the show, and I felt so comfortable knowing that we had a theme and that I really liked it. So thanks a lot for writing the show that's guided us these past 5 or 6 years.
Hey, it was my pleasure, man. Thank you for sticking with it. Yeah.
Do you remember when you found out that we were going to be using the theme or anything?
Yeah. We were absolutely chuffed because that song was actually one of the first songs that my brother and I worked on as bros.
Yeah.
You know, so it was sort of like we were just starting this fledgling project and we were kind of wondering, you know, what people were going to make of it. And then that song was just sort of a miracle for us in that it was licensed, you know, to sporting arenas. It was in TV shows and movies. But the greatest of all, Q, oh, baby.
Come on.
You know,
get out of here.
Pretty sweet.
Get out of here. And top. Like streamed song, or
yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, it's to date, it's our top streamed song. It's just been a wild success for us. So,
10% is all I want.
we can talk after.
We'll talk afterwards. Let's talk about this new project. So thank you for that, by the way.
Thank you, man.
Let's talk about your new project. It's called Seamus. It's a fantasy concept album called The Shepherd and the Wolf.
That's right.
Can you do a little world building for us here?
Absolutely. Well, so if people aren't familiar with a fantasy concept album, it's a concept record, like akin to a rock opera, something like, you know, Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd or, you know, Tommy by The Who. So it's, you know, a collection of songs that are linked thematically by the same kind of narrative. So we're doing storytelling here, but instead of words and phrases, it's guitar solos and Hammond organ, you know, that kind of stuff.
How did that come to you?
Well, I love fantasy. You know, I've spent a lot of time driving around tour vans with the Sheepdogs, reading giant fantasy paperbacks and stuff like that. You know, when I was a kid, I used to watch Jason and the Argonauts every day after school. My dad had taped it on VHS off TV, and I would watch the skeleton fight. You know, Ray Harryhausen's animated skeletons fighting Jason and the heroes of ancient Greece. So I love, you know, myths and monsters and those kind of stories, and I really wanted to, you know, try and tell a story like that, but do it musically. And I thought, what better way than a fantasy rock concept record?
This is the first record then in all the years I've been doing this show that's ever come in with a card game associated with it.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, especially as the record kind of like started to take shape, we really realized that we were creating like a fantasy world for people to get lost in. Like in the liner notes there, you can see there's a fantasy map to the album.
Yeah.
And so we were really like, you know, we're creating a whole world here. So as we flushed out the mythology, I thought it would be great to do like, oh man, a card game would be awesome. Just like another way for people to interact with this fantasy world, you know. And the card game, you know, all the cards have references to lyrics in the music, you know. So you get to know the characters and the places and, you know, oh yeah, old Mother Nature's woods or the Giant's Eye Mountain. I know that from the album, you know, and you see them in the card game.
Have you played the card game?
I have.
And?
Yeah.
And?
It's good. It's a totally playable tabletop game. It's great. It's fun. It's quick. You know, easy to play. Difficult to master.
Not unlike your album.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I was talking to the engineer. Tell me, we're going to play the track one off the record. Is that the track, right? The Wolf Moon? That's the track, first track off the record?
Yeah, it's called The Days of High Adventure.
Oh, the Days of High Adventure. Oh, my mistake. So hold on. Is this going to be like, is this going to be like the, you know, like, are you going to outline the plot in this song? Is this how this works?
Exactly, yeah, it's the introduction to the record. So, you know, think about the
the overture?
Yeah. Well, there is a song called Overture on there, too. But
okay.
that's side two. but this is, it introduces the character of the shepherd. So we introduce the mythology. And in the Days of High Adventure, the shepherd comes down from the mountain with a warning to the townsfolk about a wolf that he's seen in the wilderness. But will they heed his warning? We'll have to listen and find out.
We're going to have to listen and find out. Seamus, you have brought me so many firsts in my life. The first theme to a cue that the radio show that I've worked on. Mm-hmm. The first time I've ever shotgunned a beer was on stage with your band, the Sheepdogs, at the Winnipeg Folk Festival.
I remember it fondly. Yeah.
First time I ever shotgunned a beer was in front of like 50,000 people with your band.
You did great. You really held your own.
Thank you very much. And I'm hoping the first tabletop card game I ever play will be this game.
Dude, absolutely.
So get me in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man.
I got lots of free time now. Can you throw to the song we're about to hear? Can you do the rock radio throw? I'm Seamus and Mama Mama.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Hi, this is Seamus Curry. You're listening to Q. Don't touch that dial, because here comes the Days of High Adventure.
Seamus with the Days of High Adventure off the upcoming album The Shepherd and the Wolf, with an accompanying card game, which is out February 24th. So look out for the card game as well. This is kind of it. It's a funny thing. I was thinking about this. I'm 35 years old, and I've been at the CBC for 14 years, if you can believe that. And I know that it's really rare for something around here to change for a good reason. Like, especially here at the CBC. And this change that's happening to our show comes because you've let us know that you enjoy our interviews, because people all over the country have asked for more of our kind of interviews. And I just want to say thank you personally, and I'm just really excited for what's about to happen. I want to give my gratitude to the Q team, who do all the real work here. I feel like I'm just the lead singer of the best band in the radio. But, you know, I'm still going to be working with them either on Q or in the office with Commotion. But there's a few people I want to single out. So Anne McKeegan, our executive producer of both shows, who has been a guiding light and trying to launch two new shows at once. Without her, I don't know. I know I wouldn't have a career without her. I actually don't know if I'd have, like, socks without her. Sally Caddo and Jen Detman for believing in me, in us, and in art in this country. Sam Hashimi, who has been and will continue to be our incredible tech day in and day out, making the show sound so incredible. And I want to thank my friend Danielle Grogan, who has been the director of the show with me since I started. She took a big risk and took a big move and came with me to this show. I feel like any success I've had live on this show has been because she's had my back every step of the way. So thanks, Danielle, for everything. Thank you to the incredible artists in this country who have given me stuff to talk about every day. I'm so excited to keep telling your stories and introducing comedians to your work. Thanks to the moms and dads who have written me to tell me about their kids' music. That always rules. And go and subscribe to the podcast, Q with Tom Power, and listen to Commotion and Q on Monday. I'm so excited for it. I'm Tom Power. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.